Fans, we are back live with another edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. My name is Jack Kilby, Executive Vice President of Great North Wrestling, and we're pleased today to welcome a man who is an author and wears several other hats, but has or is about to release a very interesting book about the pro wrestling business, and we'll get into all facets of that. It's called The Six Pack on the Open Road to WrestleMania, and that would be Brad Baloogian. How are you, sir?
Doing well, Jack. Thanks for having me on.
I right away the theme of the book and the time frame of the book I find to be quite an interesting period in the business for obvious reasons, but Could you explain the premise of the book first?
Sure. Well, the backstory of the book is that I had gotten to know the Iron Sheik personally. He was my favorite wrestler as a kid. And I got to know him when I was in college, when he was kind of on the downslope of his career. And just kind of hit it off with him. We became friends. And as someone who was getting into journalism, I worked at a magazine called Islands Magazine. As I got to know his story and got to know him, I realized, wow, this guy's got a fascinating life story well beyond wrestling that encompasses everything from geopolitics to, you know, the stuff with the Shah of Iran and amateur wrestling. All kinds of different themes. And so I thought, well, this story should be told. So I had left my job at the magazine back in 2005 to work with him, to partner with him on writing his story. And the whole thing went completely sideways. And he was in the throes of addiction. It was not a good time for him. And so that project completely fell apart. And I went on with my life and moved on. And then in the back of my head, I always wanted to revisit that story in some way. After my first book, The Wax Pack, did well a few years ago, I thought, okay, this could be the time to revisit it. And so what I wanted to do at this point was not just write an Iron Sheik biography, but to write a book that's really about professional wrestling, where it comes from, but most importantly, how it affects the guys that do it, and focusing on that 1980s WWF era. So what I did is I chose a bunch of wrestlers that all wrestled on the Madison Square Garden card on December 26, 1983, when the Iron Sheik became champion. And I said, okay, those are going to be the guys that I'm going to track down on the road. And this is very much a book of original reporting. It's a travel book where I get on the road. I drive 12,525 miles to find all these guys and tell the story of basically for each of them, to what extent did they become their character?
Mm-hmm. Aside from the Sheik, which we'll get into in more detail, of course, who were the main individuals that you focused on for the book? And if you could talk about your process of, tracking some of them down, some are easier to find than others, like Tito Santana, but your process for finding them and then going in and speaking to them.
Right. Well, I knew I wasn't going to get to everybody. There were 16 people that were still alive that wrestled on that card, and that would have been just too crowded for the book. So I picked six guys, the six pack here, which was Iron Sheik, Tito Santana, Bill Eadie, who at the time was the Mass Superstar and later Demolition Axe, Tony Atlas, Sergeant Slaughter, and Jose Luis Rivera. And then I added in Hulk Hogan because he's such an integral part of the story, and then Vince McMahon because he's the promoter behind it all. And I had a lot of help from Eric Bischoff, who I had gotten to know through the Wax Pack with getting in touch with people. But a lot of it was just old-fashioned journalistic digging, you know, looking in public record databases for phone numbers, sending letters, trying to get to people. And of course, as I expected, not everybody wanted to talk to me. So there were some situations where I had to, you know, do my best to go tell their story by meeting people that they knew when they were kids or their, you know, other parts of their lives. So it really varied from person to person, but I was really happy with the amount of access I ended up getting and the number of people that were willing to talk to me, both the wrestlers themselves and people that knew them.
Out of the huge amount of material that you probably collected, out of the main interviews, what jumped out at you? And interestingly, was there a commonality amongst on this channel? We do a lot of interviews with the old school, quote unquote, guys, and they seem to, you know, have some, no matter where they work, they seem to share some significant commonalities in the experience of what the business was like back then. Was that your experience too?
For sure. These guys this was like the ultimate pressure cooker time in the WWF when they were running, you know, three or four shows a night. So there were a lot of things these guys had in common. I like to say that this really is a book about them as people, and it's really the human stories. So, you know, for someone that's looking for just a book about road stories or ribs or, you know, details of backstage stuff, I mean, there's some of that in there, but it's more about, I'm really proud of the original reporting that I was able to do, like finding the first CFO for the WWF in 1983, the person that actually fit, you know, was managing the money for Vince McMahon and could tell me firsthand how they financed their expansion in 1984 and could tell me how much Hulk Hogan got paid for WrestleMania I. Only he would know that, Hulk Hogan and probably Vince McMahon. I was able to find a lot of guys from the front office, and I was able to get into a lot of stories like Tony Atlas, who, you know, told me some really just deep, dark stuff that he had to deal with growing up in an orphanage in Western Virginia, having to fight every day to not get raped by other people in the orphanage, for example. Some of the really awful racist stuff that he encountered early in his life and throughout his wrestling career. Tito Santana talking about having a gay son and what that was like to go through that as a professional wrestler, and also finding out just in the last few years that he had a daughter he didn't know about. And so it's really about the effect of the road on all these guys. And as you're alluding to, if you've talked to a bunch of guys from that time, you know, they all have the common stories of how difficult it was to maintain your sanity, let alone your family life, when you were on a plane every single day and your body is being, you know, broken down. And get into that as well, the issue of these guys being classified as independent contractors and how Bill Eadie sued Vince McMahon and the inside story of that lawsuit. So, you know, I guess you could say I was on a mission of fact checking. I was on a mission to find the truth in wrestling, which is really challenging, but I really took a kind of investigative journalist's approach to the subject matter of like, okay, I'm going to really do everything I can to get to the actual truth of who these guys were in their real lives.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's a work that's chock full of, you know, rather unrecognized or rather underreported, I guess would be the right word, information, you know, of the business of the business. Out of all of that material in terms of the business practices of the time, what was the most surprising element that jumped out? I mean, fans, and where I'm going with this is fans have heard about, you know, how Vince literally had to, he was going to sink if WrestleMania I wasn't a success. And there were some pretty dire accounting going on there. But what jumped out at you by talking to those office people?
Well, the one thing is that the Bob McMullen, who was the CFO, said that that's a little bit overstated, the idea that Vince was going to go bankrupt. I mean, it was definitely a big gamble, WrestleMania I, but he told me that he never saw Vince put any of his personal money into the business. And he told me that that when he got to the company, they hadn't even consolidated Vince Sr.'s company, Capital Sports, with Titan Sports. So they had to do a lot of changing of the business practices to bring them up to speed. I guess one of the things that surprised me was learning how just how little when they made the expansion from closed circuit to pay-per-view, they were making just fistfuls of money off of those pay-per-view revenues, but they weren't necessarily giving any of that to the talent. Like, the talent would get a better payoff if it was a pay-per-view, but it wasn't like they were calculating their payoffs based on some percentage of the pay-per-view revenue. So that's one way that they just made a lot of money that didn't trickle down to the talent. I mean, maybe trickle down to Hulk Hogan, or sort of, you know, Hulk had his own contract, which was different from everybody else. But most of these guys, you know, Vince basically strong-armed them into signing boilerplate contracts starting in 1984 that gave them almost no rights. I mean, gave them zero guarantee of any merchandising money. So, you know, even Vince was giving them peanuts on their merchandise and probably looked at that as being generous, since contractually he didn't have to give them anything on their merchandise. Mm. So, you know, Vince had all the power and all the control, and he made sure to have that locked up as much as possible. And anyone who went against him, like Jesse Ventura, you know, Sergeant Slaughter, you know, they ended up usually out of the company in some way.
Mm. And speaking to Sergeant Slaughter, Bob Remus, that issue must have been one that to this day is you know, somewhat of a, you know, holds animosity towards, because here the conception was, at least in the general public, which knew a lot less than they do now, that, you know, you see the superstars with the posters, the little LGN dolls and the t-shirts and blah blah blah, that they're getting a fair cut of that. But then when they're not, and Slaughter had the opportunity with G.I. Joe, which I guess he was flat out told that he couldn't do, that was somewhat revolutionary at the time, and later with Jesse Ventura and the video game. But do you get the sense that there's some ill will from those superstars of the past compared to some of the more generous contracts that developed later?
Yeah, I don't think any of the guys that I met with really care for Vince McMahon, the person. I think that they had a certain degree of respect, or they had a certain degree of respect for him, and certainly feared him to a large extent. But I mean, I think Hulk Hogan is a bit of an exception in that I think he and Vince were very tight, almost brothers, but also at each other's throat a lot. But for the rest of them, yeah, I think that there's some, you know, resentment of how Vince handled business when it came to how he treated them as people.
Looking back, I know you said this isn't one of the typical road story books and ribs and et cetera, but were any of the stories that you were privy to, and you touched on it earlier a bit with the terrible travel schedule and the time away from family, et cetera, did any of those surprise you in terms of those working conditions?
Well, I think the working conditions have been so well documented over the years that none of it surprised. I mean, I saw Hulk Hogan's hotel, you know, receipts and his travel itinerary, and, you know, I was able to actually see some of his, because I was able to interview his assistant, essentially his roadie back in 1989, who had saved a lot of his material with his schedule. And I was just looking at, like, wow, I mean, just seeing this, you know, he was on a tour in Germany, and it was not only wrestling, but just the promotional stuff, like just every hour, just constant. And then I actually, as part of the book, went in the ring myself and did a day of training, because I wanted to know, you know, what does it feel like to take a bump and to go through all this and run the ropes. And after doing that, it's like, oh man, if I could, you know, if I had to do this on top of the travel and everything. It's a miracle that anyone lasted more than a few months on that schedule. And you can totally understand why there were so many divorces or so many, you know, strained relationships or issues with kids. And, you know, it was just not, it was a, just a, not a sustainable lifestyle.
Mm-hmm, for sure. In addition to the CFO, you spoke to, I guess, some of the other office staff of that period. Could you discuss that a little bit and their the positions that they held?
Well, sure. I was able to meet up with Jim Troy, who was the senior vice president of Titan Sports. Came in 1982 when Titan Sports was pretty much a new company. You know, Vince, Jim was one of three people to go, well, just him, Linda, and Vince going to the Warwick Hotel in New York City in June of 1982 to buy the company from his dad. And Jim was one of the guys that was there at that meeting and, you know, buying it from Phil Zacco and Gorilla Monsoon and Vince Sr. and Arnold Skoland. And so he was there from day one, basically, and told me about, you know, back at this point, Vince is living in South Yarmouth, Massachusetts, running the Cape Cod Coliseum. And so Jim Troy was there when he helped set up the meeting to get the WWF on the USA Network. He was there when the company, well, he was part of the move to Greenwich, Connecticut in the fall of 83. And shortly after that, they brought in Nelson Sweglar to kind of shape up their TV production. So I was able to interview him. And they also brought in Ed Helinski to run their magazine along with Steve Taylor. So I was able to interview Ed about the earliest WWF magazine. And then shortly after Ed, there was Ed Ricciuti was brought in to do the magazine and Tom Emanuel was the publisher. And I was able to talk to both of them. Mike Breen, who was in merchandise and a referee, interviewed him. So all these guys were there in like 82, 83, 84, which was that pivotal time period when Vince started expanding. And Jim Troy told me about, you know, going on the road with a guy named Joe Perkins, who's passed away. These were the actual guys that went out into to meet with TV station managers to convince them to put Vince's show on the air instead of the more local programming and sort of the syndication blitz that Vince went on. So, yeah, I mean, I was able to, I mean, this isn't a book just about that expansion, but I was able to, you know, in order to tell the story of the Iron Sheik and Hulk Hogan from that era, you have to kind of set the context for how Vince was able to grow so rapidly.
Mm. That's fascinating stuff in and of itself, though. In terms of the Sheik and your relationship, you really developed a relationship with him. How did you find him? To be when you were dealing with him and getting his story, was there a separation between you know, the person and the character? Or because there seemed to be, at least in his latter years with the Howard Stern appearances and et cetera, that he was always on and you know, portraying that I guess it was a variation of his original character to be a more wild and crazy, et cetera, guy. But what were the highlights of your dealings with the man?
Yeah, I really, you know, that's, I think, one of the highlights of this book is you get to see the Iron Sheik in his living room watching Friends and Rachel Ray. And, you know, a view of him that pretty much no one other than his family or closest friends has seen. Because you're right, when he got his second wave of popularity in the 2000s, he was just in essentially working a character, right? He and that was influenced and fueled by his drug addiction. I mean, he was just not in his right mind. And then he got all this affirmation and sort of exploited to be this, you know, character that would just go off on Brian Blair and Hulk Hogan. And it was people just winding him up and to entertain themselves. And he ate it up because, you know, these wrestlers, they do love the attention. They want that publicity. But away from all that, you know, I really, you know, again, I go back and I interview the guy that first brought Khosrow Vaziri. That's the Iron Sheik's real name. to the United States in 1969 when he came to the U.S. from Iran, not speaking a word of English. And the one person he knew was a guy named Alan Rice, who coached the Minnesota Wrestling Club. So from 1969 to 1976, there is no Iron Sheik. There's Khosrow Baziri, a outstanding Greco-Roman wrestler who helped coach the U.S. Olympic team, who then helped train all these Minnesota wrestlers who became Olympians, like Dan Chandler and Pat Marcy. And, you know, after he turned pro in 1972, he wrestles professionally for 4 years as Ali Vaziri and Khosrow Vaziri, but is just a very clean cut, straight laced baby face that doesn't get over. And so I was able to find and talk to those guys, Pat Marcy and Dan Chandler, that knew him before he was the Iron Sheik, right? Along with his wife, Carol, who he met in 1975. And talking to these people that knew him as Khosrow Vaziri, you really get a sense of who the Iron Sheik really is, you know, beyond that character. And that's, I think, one of the things that I'm proudest of in the book is that I would say this is like the closest you could ever get to seeing what he really was like, you know, because he unfortunately passed away last year. So yeah, I would say that's kind of the real cause.
Mm-hmm. And you had, of course, a chapter on Vince McMahon, and there must have been, speaking of volume of materials, you touched on it earlier that he, you know, is, to say the least, prior to the most recent lawsuits, was considered a very polarizing figure at best. What in terms of compiling that information, what sense did you get of, you know, and which has been muddied over time with the television Mr. McMahon character, and we won't even talk about the current time frame, but what did you get a sense of what he was and his true motivations through your work and how he treated people?
I think Vince is just a really damaged individual from a damaged childhood. You know, that story's been told a little bit. I go into that a little bit. There's a lot of trauma in his early life. And I think Vince was really motivated by power, by money, by, I think he just had huge ambitions and always wanting to prove something. And I think some of that probably stems from having been rejected by his own father until he was, you know, 14 or 15 years old, and kind of trying to fill a void there. And I think Vince, I think he changed. I think in the earlier years of the WWF, he was maybe a little more balanced and sympathetic to some of the needs of the people that worked for him. But he really, I think, kind of went off the deep end at some point. And like I said, you know, he's one of the only people in the book that comes across, you know, not great in terms of, once you look at the weight of the evidence of how everyone I talked to talked about him. But I was able to, I think, uncover a lot of, so I was able to get a lot of really documentation and material that had never been found before, like office memos that he wrote in 1984. And Linda McMahon played a huge role in the company in the early years in terms of making sure it was successful and getting some of these internal documents from the company in those years, and things that show how much guys got paid and how much the gate was at this house show and how much pay-per-views were making. And so the sad thing about a book is you only can put a 5% of the material in there. So I actually am going to put all this material online as part of a sort of a bonus section, bonus materials for the book at thebradpack.com is where I'm going to have all this material. So the book is, then of course all the photos I took, which are not in the book. So there's a lot more than just the book itself.
Mm-hmm. Same question about Hulk Hogan in terms of the picture of the man during that time frame. And again, another polarizing figure. He's had his own public ups and downs, but your sense of him in that time frame as well.
Well, I think Terry Bollea is a more sympathetic character than Vince. I think certainly also ambitious, but I think Terry, to some extent, will always be the 10-year-old overweight kid that didn't really fit in. I think, you know, he had a lot of insecurity himself. But with Terry, with Hulk Hogan, it's like, okay, I have one chapter on Hulk Hogan. How do I write something that has not already been told, when the guy's got two autobiographies and however many TV shows and documentaries and books? So I really focused on two things in that chapter. Number one, fact-checking this idea that he had his leg broken when he broke in by Hiro Matsuda. So I was able to go to Jerry Briscoe's house and interview him about that, along with some other people that would have known. And number two was to look at the role of his music career in shaping who he became as a wrestler. And that's something that's been alluded to, but I actually was able to find two of the guys he was in bands with, one of them the lead singer in Ruckus, which was his most successful band. And that's what he was doing right before he quit to become a wrestler. So I was able to fact check a lot of that history about, you know, what Hulk Hogan's music career was all about.
That must have been, you know, doubly challenging, the fact checking portion, considering, you know, Hogan has received a lot of criticism, valid or not, about his tendency to exaggerate or outright fib. Was that a consideration for you when coming across this information about extra time dedicated to verification, et cetera?
Oh yeah. I mean, that was the main point, was like fact checking whatever has been out there. Right. And I think Hulk Hogan, I think Terry Bollea is, with his tall tales, is well-intentioned. I think he's, as Eric Bischoff once said, he's saying what he thinks people want to hear. I don't think he's intentionally deceiving people in a malicious way. And I think some of these guys also don't actually know anymore. Like, you know, some of these untruths have been repeated and circulated so often that no one even knows. Like, a lot of wrestlers thought that Bob Remus really was in the military, you know, mm-hmm. and they were shocked to learn, you know, Bret Hart's talked about that. He was shocked that, you know, because even like off camera back in the 80s, like Bob Remus told Bret Hart, oh yeah, I was in the military. Like, these guys were living the gimmick. Mm-hmm. And so their memories can be faulty. Their command of the truth can be very loose, but it's not always in a malicious way. I mean, a lot of it is just, it's conditioned because they were trained for their whole careers to live this illusion.
Mm-hmm. And working is that term. And I know you have a glossary of formerly inside terms in your book. Working is always been, and to this day, to a lesser degree, is considered to be a great worker, is probably the highest praise that one individual in the business can bestow upon another one.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, right. It's all about the work. Yeah.
And you mentioned Bischoff, and you've got some pretty high praise for your work here from not only Bischoff, but Foley and Mick Foley and Chris Jericho, et cetera, et cetera. You're pleased with that outcome, but were you taken aback that it was so well received, particularly by a guy like Bischoff, who's got one of the greatest minds for the business of all time?
Well, I was very just overjoyed that these guys liked it. I mean, the people that I approached with it were like with Bret Hart and Jericho and Bischoff and Foley. And the people I chose were people that I thought would appreciate it. Right. So I could have gone to any number of wrestlers out there, but the guys that I went to had demonstrated some degree of sort of intellectual curiosity and understanding in an analytical way of the wrestling business, and the ability to articulate, you know, some of the appeal of it. And I think that just, you know, and someone like Bret Hart, I just always felt like had a lot of integrity. And I guess you could say my goal in this book was to be detailed, honest, and balanced. And knowing that those are qualities that I think Bret Hart respects, I approached him about the book and then was, you know, overjoyed when he wrote me this long email saying how much he loved it. So, you know, the people I approached was certainly a very, you know, for people I chose for a reason. And I greatly respected their opinion. So for them to enjoy it that much, yeah, I was really, I couldn't ask for a better outcome there.
Do you have any plans per se to do your first book was on baseball. Then you have this one. Do you, given the fact that I think you're, and as the men in the business have put over, you're on to, taking a unique approach to some material that some feel is, you know, completely plumb, but do you have any other ideas or ambitions for other wrestling related work?
Yeah, I mean, I love wrestling. I especially love this era. And I describe it not just in wrestling, but baseball and sports is like, it's basically the pre-internet era, right? But, you know, not too far back, but looking at the 70s, 80s, 90s, sort of Generation X, that's my sweet spot. And so I would love to continue telling the stories of the athletes and the wrestlers from that time. And so my plan is that with this website, the bradpack.com that I mentioned earlier, where I'm going to have the bonus material, I'm also going to do some new material, some new interviews with people from that time period, new content. And at some point, you know, maybe do another book. I don't know if it would be on wrestling or another group of people from that time period, but clearly there's an appetite and demand for the nostalgia of that time period that a lot of us recall very fondly. So, and I think there's a lot of stories that are out there. And, you know, again, one of the themes in both my first book and my second book is that some of the more underknown or the underdog personalities, like in this book, it's Jose Luis Rivera, who I go to Puerto Rico to interview him and was amazed at some of his stories about, again, things that hadn't been told before about how Jose Gonzalez, the guy that we all pretty sure murdered Bruiser Brody, you know, how he kind of screwed over Jose Luis in the WWF in 1984. I was able to go, you know, Jose Luis showed me his whole history and the conquistador stuff, and he was the Black Demon and the Red Demon and being a jobber in the early 80s. And so those stories, I mean, when I was doing my research on Jose Luis, that you couldn't find anything. I mean, Wikipedia said he was born 7 years after he was. This website said he died. And, you know, there was so much wrong information out there. So I think to take a journalist's and a researcher's, you know, very careful eye and level of scrutiny to this material can uncover a lot of, you know, untold stories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, where can the fans pick up the book? I know you've mentioned you have a website, but please give everyone all the information that they need here.
Sure. Thanks, Jack. So the book comes out April 2nd. And as they say, wherever books are sold, so you can get it online, Amazon, any retailer, you can get it at your local bookstore. A lot of stores should have it in stock. My website is thebradpack.com, so you can check out the additional material there. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram at bradpackbooks. So please, you know, check it out, interact, write me a question, tell me what you think. And I love, you know, this is one of the most fun parts of the process is just getting to talk to readers after it finally comes out.
Quick question before we wrap up, not necessarily related to the book. Well, sort of, because it's about the road to WrestleMania. You must be impressed given that you have an old school appreciation of the build towards this year's WrestleMania, especially the main event. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I'm actually going to be at WrestleCon. I'll be in Philadelphia for WrestleMania week, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm impressed the last couple of years how the WWE has rediscovered some of their old storytelling techniques, whether it's having Roman Reigns and Gunther have be champion for like long periods of time, the long build, the big storyline over years, you know, with Cody Rhodes. I think they've gone back to some of those things that served them well, you know, years ago. So I am impressed with some of those storylines. I think the current product, I guess one of my biggest complaints is that some of the in-ring stuff is gotten to be so flippy floppy that, you know, it's so many high spots that it's like the psychology of it is just different than it was when we were younger. And I guess, you know, younger fans probably don't mind. That's just what they're conditioned maybe to have this all, you know, these high spots. And so it's just trying to one-up each other. But if you knew wrestling in the kayfabe era, it just doesn't quite sit right sometimes.
Yeah, I could not agree more. But fans, check out the six-pack on the open road in search of WrestleMania. It's definitely a very, very interesting read. And again, several angles of the material covering, you know, what impressed me about it was the fact that there was, you know, again, material that you would think has been covered, but this is definitely a innovative. That's the adjective I was looking for. Innovative approach to that time frame, and highly recommended. So, Brad, thank you very much for coming on today. And if you do further works along these lines, please let us know. We'd be happy to have another discussion.
Great. No, thanks. Thanks for having me. And look forward to future projects.
Well, fans, that's it for this edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jack Kilby. See you next time.